Professor Rita Levi Montalcini, born on April 22, 1909, in Turin, Italy, left an indelible mark on the field of neuroscience through her groundbreaking discoveries and unwavering dedication to scientific inquiry, despite being forced at one point to conduct her research from the confinements of her bedroom in Turin. From her pioneering research on nerve growth factor, or NGF in short, to her advocacy for gender equality in academia, Rita's contribution continued to inspire generations of scientists worldwide. Hello, curious cats, and welcome. Before we begin, I would like to encourage you to give a listen to other episodes on the scientists I found inspirational. I'm making this podcast as a hobby alongside my PhD studies, which lately have been oh so delightful. I definitely needed some motivation myself. I would love to hear from you on any feedback you have. Don't hesitate to drop an email or a comment. And in other news, I am starting a new mini-series on the model organisms that made all the scientific advancements possible, because I think their lives are also worth remembering and cherishing. Thank you for being a listener. I really appreciate it. Now back to our story. Rita was born into a distinguished Italian Jewish family and grew up with her twin sister Paola. Her parents instilled in them a deep appreciation for education and intellectual pursuit. Despite the traditional roles her father tried to impose on her, Rita was determined to break these barriers. Her interest in science and her commitment to helping others led her to a career in medicine. Like many scientists featured on this podcast, it seems to me that being told no correlates to a great scientific career and sometimes to a Nobel Prize. So, I don't know, maybe ask a parent or a good friend to play the bad guy with the promise of sharing the prize with them and let me know how that goes. I'm seeing a pattern. I think we might be onto something. Anyway, at the age of 20, Rita chose to deviate from the path her father, Adamo Levi, had imagined for her. She was acutely aware of the marginalized position women held in predominantly male society and was resolved to challenge these gender biases. After gaining the support of her mother, she successfully persuaded her father to let her study medicine, overcoming his initial reluctance. Facing the academic challenges head-on, she completed her required studies in just 8 months and began attending the University of Turin School of Medicine in 1930. I found it funny how her act of rebellion was to choose medicine when many parents nowadays would probably kill to have their kid as a doctor. Initially, she considered becoming a writer and admired Swedish writer Selma Lagerlöf, but after seeing a close family friend die of stomach cancer, she decided to attend the University of Medicine. Rita's academic pursuits were marked by resilience in the face of adversity. Under the tutelage of renowned Italian histologist Giuseppe Levi, intricacies of neurogenesis, exploring the mechanisms underlying nerve cell development and migration, her fascination with the developing nervous system fueled her research endeavors, laying the groundwork for the groundbreaking discoveries in the years to come. As Mussolini's regime tightened its grip on Italy and enacted discriminatory racial laws targeting Jewish citizens, Rita faced mounting challenges as a Jewish scientist. In 1939, amidst rising persecution, she made a difficult decision to end her work at the University of Turin, seeking refuge in her research at the Neurological Institute. However, the looming threat of Hitler's influence compelled her to return to Turin in 1940, where she established a makeshift lab in her bedroom to continue her pioneering studies on neurogenesis in the chick embryo, while aiding fleeing Jews from the wrath of the war. Despite the tumultuous backdrop of World War II, Rita's unwavering commitment to scientific inquiry remained steadfast. Her groundbreaking experiments on chick embryos, conducted under the extraordinary circumstances, gave insights into the role of limb buds in neuronal development. The limb buds are basically the incipient structure in the embryo from where the limb will later arise, as the name might suggest. At the time, not much was known about the process. Inspired by Victor Hamburger's seminal work, another scientist I mentioned before, very important in developmental biology, Rita meticulously dissected and stained chick embryos, unraveling the intricate processes governing neuronal proliferation, differentiation, and survival. Shortly after the war's conclusion, Victor Hamburger, a prominent German researcher whose earlier work had inspired Rita to delve into nerve cell development, reached out to her. Having resided in the United States since before the conflict, Hamburger was intrigued by Rita's research, which she had ingeniously managed to disseminate in Belgium and the Vatican to circumvent bans in Italy. Impressed by her, he extended an invitation for her at Washington University in St. Louis as a postdoctoral fellow. What was supposed to be maybe a few months to maybe a year of work in that lab extended to over 30 years of being in the US and conducting her research. And now, science time. So, before I proceed with the science section of this episode, as always, I'll give you the question of the episode. For people new here, I asked the audience a science-related question close to the topic of the episode, so we can all keep our curiosity sharp and, why not, learn some more things today. So here it goes. What is the animal that can regenerate limbs, nerves, and even brains when amputated or damaged, making them the cutest freak of nature? I have a little hint. They look like they always have a smile on their face, which from some angles is bordering the creepy smiley emoji that refuses to disappear from the messaging apps. I think we should start a petition about that. But anyway, back to our subject. This time, compared to other episodes, I will focus less, maybe, on the very hard science. Of course, I also talk about it because I find it very fascinating, but I will also read an excerpt from her autobiographical book called In Praise of Imperfection, My Life and Work, which I highly recommend. You can find it maybe in libraries, and if you don't, online you can find it on archive.org. And it is a raw but elegant account of her long and very fruitful life. I'd say long because she lived up to 103 years old, and up until the end she was still in the lab doing research. The excerpt I chose is about the moment she made her great discovery while being in the USA, where she lived the last part of her life after the war. And I chose it because it perfectly illustrates the grand moments every scientist seeks, which keeps them going in the face of failure and hardship. This builds up grit, which I think all of us have to develop, as life, for most of us, doesn't leave us unbothered. Yeah, that's the word I was seeking, definitely. She said the following about these crucial but challenging times. I quote, "My doubts about the future of my research, which had led me to seek Luriel Dubeco's advice and been the cause of many sleepless nights, were not to last long. From one day to the next, and in an entirely unforeseeable way, I regained faith in and the enthusiasm of experimental neuroembryology that I thought irretrievably lost. It happened in the course of one afternoon in late autumn of 1947, while I was somewhat haphazard examining under the microscope the latest series of silver-stained chick embryo sections. Their coloring had come out perfectly. The nerve cells that had begun to differentiate in the cerebral vesicles and spinal cord, the embryos had been fixed between the third and the seventh days of incubation, stood out in their every detail with the deep brown, blackish hue on the golden yellow background of the non-impregnated cord tissue, formed of satellite cells and as yet undifferentiated nerve cells. My attention was drawn to the spinal cord, which revealed, even at first glance, a surprising variety of scenarios, not only in its different segments, but in embryos at the same stage of development and fixed just a day or few hours apart, also within the same segment. The thoracic and sacral segments offered the spectacle not unlike that of the maneuvers of large armies on a battlefield. Thousands of cells were proceeding in long columns to form the spinal cord. The migration began on the fourth day of incubation and ended on the sixth, when the cells reached their destination at the sites of the central canal. The identical modalities with which, in all of the cases I examined, the various phases of the process took place revealed the genetic programming at work, and at the same time the striking similarities between these processes and those that, in respect to the migration of birds, insects, locusts, termites, and ants, we view as revealing to workings of instinct. In the case of the migrations of living organisms, one can fall back on this vague term which explains everything and therefore explains nothing. In the case of cells, unable as we are instincts, since we do not attribute to them even hypothetical powers of decision, one speaks of the activation of a genetic program, not essentially different from programs that programmers draw up for computers. The thin dividing line between the realization of an instinct and of a program lies merely in the assumption that the former is a property of multicellular organisms, in which we recognize the presence of a grouping, rudimentary as it may be, of nerve cells in charge of an individual's behavior. Whereas the latter is common to living entities such as unicellular organisms or cells, and to inanimate objects such as computers as well. That day, however, as I peered through the microscope, nerve cells were acquiring a personality that not usually attributed to them. At the cervical level, I was witness to the disappearance of the membrane marking the boundaries of the nucleus, the retraction of the nerve fiber, and a decrease in the volume of the cell bodies. In immediately successive stages, the same cells acquired an appearance known in histological terminology as pygnotic, or indicating the establishment of a process of irreversible degeneration. The impression was that of a battlefield covered with corpses. In embryos fixed at the stage immediately afterwards, that is 10 to 24 hours later, this sector was invaded by macrophages, or cells able to ingest and destroy bacteria, the dendritus of others, degenerated cells. The image that suggested itself to me was of corpses being removed from a battlefield by special crews trained and equipped for the purpose. A few hours later, all traces of cellular detritus had vanished. The column of cells still differentiating was vastly reduced in diameter, and an inspection of the fibers of the cells that comprise it revealed that they were innervating the muscles of the same segment of the trunk. The reconstruction of these many processes, which took place in my mind in the span of an hour, filled me with joy. It struck me that the discovery of great migratory and degenerative processes affecting nerve cell population at the early stages of their development might offer a tenuous yet valid path to follow into the fascinating and uncharted labyrinth of the nervous system. The doubts about the future of experimental neuroembryology, which had prompted me to seek Luria's advice, had been based on the conviction that it would have been impossible to unveil the mechanisms underlying neurogenesis with the theoretical and technical means then at our disposal. The absence of valid criteria to follow in such a venture was even more evident in the light of comparisons between this field of study and those of genetics and virology, in which thanks to excellent models and sound verified principles, always newer and greater heights were being reached. Not only did the nervous system not lend itself to experimental analysis, but its enormous complexity seemed to discourage all attempts to espy whatever might be taking behind the scenes, as it were. The starting realization that nerve cell populations were subject to quotas and to the elimination of excess numbers in their ranks, as well as the migration that went hand in hand with functional differentiation, showed that there were ontogenetic processes at work in the nervous system, which were not as inaccessible to investigation as I had previously imagined. In that intoxicated state, I knocked on Victor's office door and asked him to follow me back to my lab bench. Scattered next to the microscope were the hundreds of slides I had just examined. I rapidly sketched the images I had observed on a piece of paper and told him my interpretation of the processes as I had mentally reconstructed them. Victor listened attentively, amused by my enthusiasm, and agreed that they were observations of extreme interest, which provided the key for the study of differentiative processes in the nervous system, up till then practically ignored. His enthusiasm, rising to the same pitch as my own and making me all the happier in light of his habitually more calm and cautious attitude, was confirmation of what since the start had struck me as a sort of a revelation. When Victor left the room, I put on one of my favorite records on the recorder player I had installed in the lab, a Bach cantata, end quote. I hope you felt, like me, the deep sense of victory which emanates from between the scientific jargon and somewhat reserved vocabulary. Making sense of life is one of the most satisfying feelings one can have. We should all celebrate and cherish these kinds of moments in our lives, even if it's not about science itself, but life happens all around us. And I would say that this was the definition of fortuitousness. Yes, the last word, if I would have it at a spelling bee contest, I would have lost, because sometimes the English language is not kind to the non-native speakers. So let's call it serendipity, is maybe an easier word. After wrapping up his work experiments, Victor Hamburger found himself in receipt of a letter and manuscript from his former student, Elmer Bücker, who had been conducting limb transplantation experiments of his own. The hypothesis centered around the idea that rapidly growing tissue might attract nerve fibers akin to a developing limb. He had transplanted small sections of proliferating tumors onto chicken embryos and observed intriguing results. Among these, the mouse sarcoma tumor showed remarkable proliferation and nerve infiltration, leading to the enlargement of nearby spinal ganglia in the embryo. So in short, what that means is that these crazy scientists were taking tumors that were found in a specific strain of mice. They can live happily, I'm not sure how happily, but quite normal lives, with a normal lifespan and on, with all the tumor. And what he did was to take those tumors and then transplant it to a chick embryo and see what happens. And this happens. He saw that this nerves were growing when you put those tumors into the developing chicken. And Hamburger, intrigued by Bücker's findings, asked Rita to promptly replicate the experiment using a certain staining technique, which was developed by Cajal, a very well-known neuroscientist. yeah, neuroembryologist actually. And her observations not only confirmed Bucher's results, but also discerned that the nerves infiltrating the tumor did not establish direct connection with its cells on tissue innervation. So usually when you have a forming, let's say, limb bud, the nerves that grow in it, they kind of form cell-to-cell contact. But in this case, the nerves were only growing towards the tumor, never actually touching it. Moreover, she noted a significant increase in nerve presence in tissue distant from the tumor long before such innervation occurred in control embryos. Rita's suspicions were further aroused when she observed nerve penetration into blood vessels draining the tumor, hinting that the tumor was actually secreting a diffusible growth-promoting factor. To confirm this, she also transplanted these tumors onto the external membranous layer enveloping the chicken embryos, so not in it, but around it, ensuring no direct contact with internal embryonic tissue, but sharing the same blood supply. And remarkably, the tumor still induced traumatic nerve growth, providing conclusive evidence that it released a soluble nerve growth promoting factor and initiating a determined quest to identify this enigmatic substance. So to do that, they were collaborating with the biochemist Stanley Cohen, and they embarked on experiments to unravel the mechanisms underlying nerve cell growth and their attraction to the tumor core. Together, they uncovered the macromolecule responsible for this phenomenon, which they dubbed as a nerve growth factor, as I said before, or NGF. They managed to extract this factor from the mouse salivary glands and purify it, and they realized that it was the same one involved in the development of the nerves. So it's still present in an adult body, which was groundbreaking. In short, why this discovery was such a big deal is because it explained essentially how this NGF promoted the nerve growth at the molecular level. It's, let's say, an equivalent in today's age will be to find a molecule that will promote the growth of an amputated limb. It's like a holy grail that a lot of scientists are after it. It has so much potential for regeneration and regenerative therapies. With this one molecule, NGF, one could promote nerve growth in a developing and adult tissue. This opened the door in our current days to the discovery of a whole class of macromolecules as well as regenerative therapies. And maybe unsurprisingly, their groundbreaking discovery of NGF earned them the Nobel Prize in recognition of their pioneering research. She later said, I quote, "It was a great honor. Still, there is no great thrill as the moment of discovery," end quote. Bill Mobley, chair of the Department of Neuroscience at the University of California San Diego School of Medicine, reflects later, I quote, "The discovery of NGF really changed the world in which we live, because now we knew that cells talk to other cells and that they use soluble factors. It was hugely important," end quote. This is another part that really highlights the importance of this discovery, because before they thought that cells are just there doing their programming and each cell knew what they're doing, but now they found out that they're actually talking to themselves and coordinating themselves and having this kind of hive mind that you potentially could tap into. As it became clear that NGF only acted on a few specific types of nerve cells, many researchers became engaged in the search for additional factors that might influence the growth and survival of other types of nerves. However, the hunt for additional factors proved to be long and arduous, and it was not until the 80s that Eve Bard, Hans Theonen, and colleagues isolated the factor from the brain, which they called brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Soon, NGF was also found to act in the brain, and two additional neurotrophins were later discovered. The discovery of growth factors in the brain ushered in a second wave of excitement for growth factor biology and spurred research to determine their role in neurodegenerative diseases and psychiatric disorders, Mobley said later. Recent studies have shown that NGF plays a role in the learning and memory, and experiments conducted by Taneos and Kalisanos research groups demonstrate that removal of NGF in either in vivo or in vitro experiment models results in the onset of an Alzheimer-like molecule syndrome, which leaves many hopeful that NGF and other neurotrophins may be useful for treating Alzheimer's disease. Furthermore, anti-AGF antibody-based therapeutics have shown promise in recent clinical trials for the prevention of pain. Further proof that Ritter's pioneering techniques and experimental findings are just as relevant today as they were half a century ago, and how kind of ripple down of later discoveries. It wasn't just one-off important, wow, never seen before, but actually you can see it as a wave when you throw, let's say, a rock into a lake. It's not just that. You see then the wave expanding and expanding and expanding and moving on. That's kind of what happened with her great discovery. However, perhaps the most recent evidence of NGF's many faceted role can be found in a 2012 PNAS article that reported that this protein factor is present in semen and modulates ovulation, linking NGF to reproductive function and suggesting that it may one day be useful for treating infertility. So this is definitely a one fix it all holy grail they found. Like NGF, Rita's never ceased to surprise and amaze. Her most recent experiments, as in January of 2012, made her the oldest member of National Academy of Science to publish. Later on, winning the prize opened many unexpected doors for her. She said, I quote, "I can do things that are very, very important, which I would never have been able to do if I did not receive it. It has given me the possibility of helping a lot of people," end quote. So this is an example of how someone that receives popularity or recognition or any sorts of prizes can do a lot of good with it. It's not an end-all, be-all. It's what you do with what you get beyond just the prize or the recognition itself. And I think that goes for, I would say, prizes and recognition in general in all of our lives. It's important what you do with them, not just that you receive them for your own ego. And beyond the confines of the lab, Rita's humanitarian spirit and advocacy for scientific funding and gender equality left an indelible mark on society. Despite facing entrenched sexism and antisemitism, she emerged as a vocal champion for scientific education and mentorship, founding foundations to support underprivileged children and African women in pursuing higher education. Her appointment as a senator for life in Italy and her victorious battle against proposed budget cuts for research underscored her unwavering commitment to advancing scientific progress and social justice. She was the first Nobel Prize winner to live up to 100 years old. And as I said before, she actually lived up to 103 years old, never having a husband or children, but nevertheless being missed by many around the world when she passed away. So, what would be the conclusion of this episode? I guess live up to 100 despite all of your enemies, or if somebody tells you no, just make your own lab in your bedroom, I guess. But no, on a serious note, my take, I guess, is the cliche to never give up. Work on that project, push through that challenge, just for the sakes of it. Sometimes this is enough. Because most likely she never started all her research with the thought that one day I will get the Nobel Prize. It's good to have, I guess, but it's not the end goal. And as we say in my mother tongue, if you are kicked out the door, come back through the window and grow together with the people around you. Rita's remarkable journey serves as a testament to the transformative power of scientific inquiry and, I think, curiosity in general, and just the pursuit of knowledge and the human spirit's capacity to transcend adversity. Her pioneering discoveries and unwavering advocacy leave an imprint on the scientific history, inspiring future generations to dare, to discover, and to make a difference in the world. So I will end with a poem written by William Butler Yeats called The Choice, which is found at the beginning of her autobiography, as I mentioned before, and it encapsulates the essence of this episode, in my opinion. So here it goes. The choice. The intellect of man is forced to choose perfection of the life or of the work. And if it take, the second must refuse a heavenly mansion raging in the dark. When all that story is finished, what's the news? In luck or out, the toil has left its mark. That old perplexity, an empty purse, or the day's vanity, the night's remorse. Thank you so much for listening and being here with me, and I'll see you next time.